When I say that I appreciate very much your attendance, your excellent listening, your encouraging words, that is all very sincere. But understand that in a much greater way, you are honoring God, and I certainly appreciate the example you set in that way. We appreciate all of our visitors and those who are not. I'm going to plan to talk to you this evening on four men on the loose. When you hear on the radio that four men are on the loose, you probably think of criminals. Four men are on the loose. Be on the lookout for. But in Daniel chapter 4, we have a case where four men are on the loose when it looked absolutely impossible for that to occur. Four men on the loose in Daniel 3 discusses at least three of these four who are strictly speaking criminals. They're considered criminals. But they're dangerous only to idolatry and pride. Now, as we set this up, last week we talked about Daniel 2. And I said there are many connections there. In Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar sees a dream in which there is an image that has a head of gold, and then the silver and the bronze and iron mixed with clay. Well, he's the image of gold. In chapter 3, you see an entire image of gold that he sets up. In Daniel 2, he bowed down and worshiped Daniel for all intents and purposes. Not with Daniel's permission or liking, but he did. In Daniel 3, all must worship this image that he has set up. In chapter 2, he threatens men with death. In fact, his own men, the men who work for him, because they won't tell him what his dream is and what it means. In chapter 3, he threatens death to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Again, his own men, because they won't do what he wants them to do by his royal fiat. And then Daniel, in chapter 2, opens his eyes to the true God. In chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego open his eyes to the true God for the second time. And just to let you know, this time it won't take either. And then in Daniel 3, he threatens Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with a consuming fire. A fire from which no one could escape. A fire through which no one could live. In Hebrews 12, a passage we went to last week, we see what the real fire is and where our real and true concern ought to be. Now, you remember the four twos? I guess if this were a Bible class, we'd say, okay, who could tell me the four twos? And I would especially hope that the young men and ladies would stand up and say, well, there's Isaiah 2, that's one of them, and Daniel 2, and Joel 2, and then Acts 2. Well, now this week we want to add Hebrews 12. We're always adding things, but we need to, because here you'll notice in verse 22 of Hebrews 12, you have come to Mount Zion. That's the one Isaiah 2 was talking about. That's what Daniel 2 was talking about. That's where the events of Joel 2 would take place. And that's what we see starting in Acts 2. But then when he gets through, he comes down to verse 28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom, here's that kingdom that is above all kingdoms. Here's that king that rules forever. Therefore, this kingdom will last forever. This king is above all kings. He is the king of kings, not Nebuchadnezzar. This is the true king of kings and lord of lords. And you'll notice that since we're receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, that ought to have some influence on us, some impact. So he adds in verse 28, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Instead of unholy fear that shrinks back from what these men may do to me if I continue to serve God, this is the reverence that puts God in first place above whatever any man can think or do. And it shows us the godly fear that says, I reverence him above all, do to me what you wish. And that's Daniel 3 as well. But then look at the next verse. For our God is a consuming fire. What you ought to concern yourself with, he's saying, is not this furnace that Nebuchadnezzar can build, because it is temporary, it is instantaneous, and it takes you to your reward just a little quicker than you intended to go. In their case, it didn't, because our God is the consuming fire. The consuming here doesn't mean that when God, the consuming fire, punishes a person eternally, that it's a matter of his being consumed. He's not saying hell is a consuming fire that consumes and then it's gone. God is the consuming fire, but he's not consumed. He doesn't go anywhere, does he? He's eternal. And furthermore, we talk about a person who is consumed with grief. He's still in existence. He hasn't ceased to be. So don't let this make you think that he's saying that the fire that consumes is a fire that ceases life. Someone wrote a book on that not long ago and tried to convince people that's what hell is. He's very, very wrong. And then as you look at the last frame, in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges that God is the God of gods. He speaks the truth. But in Daniel 3, he's going to call him the Most High God, after thinking he was, apparently. Now, as we look at this thing, first of all, we talk about the proud king. We're in Daniel 3, verse 1 says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits. Since a cubit is the distance from your elbow to the tip of your fingers, it varied a little because people's elbow to the finger distance varies a couple of 3 inches. But it's typically, this would be some 90 feet in the air. So that's quite a large statue of whatever it is. And also its width 6. That would be 9 cubits wide, 9 feet wide rather. And he set it up in the plain of Dura, which we think was probably about 5 or 6 miles outside the city proper where they would be meeting in Babylon. And I'm impressed by the fact, don't lose your place here, but in Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah 41 is describing God's prophecy of King Cyrus. And we're launching ahead into history after Babylon here. This is going to be the one who brings down Babylon. Babylon's been established for quite a while. Years have passed. But this is a prophecy. Isaiah is writing before it occurs. And he's talking about this one, verse 2, he would rise up from the east. That's King Cyrus. And he's talked about him and will a couple of times in this book by name, 200 years before he arrives. And he talks about God giving him the nations before him and made him rule over kings. Who did all this? Who gave them as the dust to his sword, as driven stubble to his bow? Pursued them and passed safely. And he goes on to talk about this. And so there's panic. The verse 5 says, the coastland saw it and feared. The only alternative to God is man. And so they have no true God. So it's man-made gods they must turn to. So the ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Everyone helped his neighbor. Here's a collective security. If we all band together and make a really good God, maybe he'll save us from King Cyrus. So he banded together. They said to his neighbor, be of good courage. Verse 7 says, so the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer inspired him, who strikes the anvil, saying, is it ready for the soldering? Then he fastened it with pegs that it might not totter. He builds this God that's going to save him, and he has to make sure that he nails it down real good, because if he doesn't, that thing can blow over. I don't find much hope in that. Do you? Well, that's the kind of thing that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. You get something 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, the wind's going to blow that over if you don't anchor it pretty well. Well, in verse 2, King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, administrators, and all the others to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, administrators, and all the others, with all the social pressure they could bring to bear, came. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then verse 4, a herald cried aloud. What a poor message. There's never been a poorer, sorrier message than a courier was sent to proclaim than this one. His message is, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Well, so much for separation of church and state. And you notice here, verse 7, so at that time, when all the people heard the sound, and it mentions the music again, all the people heard, it says again that all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. It's compulsory. They know if they don't, they'll burn up. Let me notice something with you that occurs. I believe I counted seven times. Verse 1 says, he set it up. Verse 2, the last two words in the verse, it's which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. In verse 3, the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. In verse 5, the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And we just saw it here in verse 7, the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. In verse 12, they do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. And then in verse 14, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up. What is that saying? That's Isaiah 41:7. This is something that a man has set up. And he's asking believers in the true God to bow before an image that a man has set up. An image that cannot see and cannot hear, it cannot curse and it cannot bless. And they're not going to do it. They have no fear of the king. They have no fear of his idol. Now, there's more to cover than we can cover. I know that sounds very scary, but I will try to keep this in proper bounds. Nebuchadnezzar acts pretty much like a silly clown on this occasion because he has seen the truth. He has seen evidence of the true God, evidence that no one else could have provided. He's told him what he dreamed. If I were to come to you and say, can you tell me what I dreamed last night? Nobody could do so. It would be a mere guess. They told him, Daniel told him in detail and then explained the prophecy. And yet he goes from that to say, Here's the idol. Here's what you worship. He thought highly of himself, didn't he? And not only this, come worship the God that I've made. He compelled verses 2 through 6. Come worship with us or we'll kill you. There was an occasion when King John in the early 1200s was the ruler of England. Every day he had a Jew in captivity, a Jew who was very rich. Every day he sent someone to pull one tooth from the Jew's mouth. Next day, pulled another tooth. Next day, pulled another tooth. Until finally, the rich Jew agreed to give him 10,000 marks. And after he pulled several teeth, the guy said, if I don't do this, I'm going to be gumming my food the rest of my life. So he gave in and gave him the money. One of the sorriest leaders that England ever had was King John. But there's a close rival in Nebuchadnezzar who had advantages that King John didn't even have and didn't learn his lesson. He gave a test of allegiance in Isaiah 14:14, speaking of Nebuchadnezzar and probably every other Babylonian king, but it's of the king of Babylon, make no doubt of it. The Lucifer in that chapter is of the king of Babylon. He says, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. You know, in chapter 3 of our text, Chapter 3, verse 27, verse 26, he refers to God as the Most High God. And yet after this, before he dies, he calls himself, I'm going to ascend up there to the Most High, as though he's equal with God. Some people never learn. He used carnal methods, the orchestra, the herald, all this was intended to manufacture something that God couldn't do for itself. Psalm 115 is a good passage to refer to here if you want a text. It shows they can't see and they can't hear. They can't answer. They can't bless you. They can't go anywhere. You have to carry them where they go. Psalm 115 is intended to ridicule those who aren't gods, but people call them so. And then he lost his temper. Anger, Horace said, is a momentary madness. And King Nebuchadnezzar illustrates that in this very chapter. Now, this man fights against the true God and loses more than his temper. And had he not corrected himself on this occasion, he would have lost even more than he did. Nebuchadnezzar is a very slow learner, as verse 15 shows us. That's one of the pivotal passages in this passage. In verse 8, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Literally, they ate the pieces of the Jews. When you slander someone, you're chewing him up. That's what this word means. In verse 9, they spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. They know how to lay it on thick to get ahead of these Jews they don't like anyway. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn and flute, and he names the others, shall fall down and worship the gold image. 11, whoever does not fall down and worship should be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Oh, do we have news for you, O king. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. We'll tell you their names. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. And at this point, we should say, well, great for them. They're obeying the God of heaven. This is the first of the commandments, then the second of the commandments. Nobody comes before God. Nobody makes an image to God. You certainly don't make one and bow down to it. What else can you tell me good about these men? That should be what Nebuchadnezzar said, how he reacted. But oh, it is not. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar in rage and fury gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We could see this coming, couldn't we? And then so they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I've set up? You know, there's a time when civil disobedience is called for, and this was one of them. Now look at verse 15. They get a second chance. Now, if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, you shall be cast immediately to the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Now in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar was the image of gold. Here the entire image is at least covered with gold. I don't know if the whole thing was solid gold, but it's at least covered with gold. Does he now make an entire statue of gold, thinking the only part about that that's important is the gold, namely me? He's that gold. Medes and Persians were silver. The Greeks were bronze. The Romans were iron mixed with clay. He's the gold. Now here's an image entirely of gold. He didn't put silver on it to honor someone else. He doesn't put bronze. He doesn't put iron and clay. It's only gold. I think I see what his point is. Let me make an application just at this point. We're told that during the past few years, there have been more people who call themselves Christians who have been slaughtered than at any time in the history. But as I look at what the early Christians went through, how they went to the arena. Do you know why they died in the arena? People say, well, it's because they worshiped Jesus. Absolutely not. It's because they would not worship Caesar. They didn't care how many gods you had. They didn't care what kind of worship you engaged in as long as you included theirs. They were convicted of hatred of mankind, hate crimes. They were, in fact, hated because they were so exclusive. Now that's what we're told we are. In modern times, Christians are called very exclusive. Back during 1936, the youth program in Nazi Germany, Herr Baldur von Schirach, Carl will tell me later what I should have said. If we act as true Christians, we act according to the laws of God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany. And whoever serves Germany serves God. You want to serve God? Serve Adolf Hitler. When you serve Adolf Hitler, you're serving God. That sounds like Nebuchadnezzar. You're serving the Most High when you serve this image I've set up. One of the former governors years ago, a woman, called pro-life Christians mongers of hate who preach their anger. Now, she supports the murder of infants, and yet we're filled with hate. Go figure. Nothing's new here, folks. This is basically the same message that's taking place in Daniel 3 and all the passages that precede it. Now look at the powerful God here. This is the most impressive part of this to me. Two things fold into one main lesson here. Because God is so great, because God is what He claims to be, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego can be what they profess to be. Namely, servants of that one God. And it doesn't matter what any man does. Man has no role in this. No one comes between them and their God. That should be my attitude. It should be your attitude. They're not the focus of this chapter. God is. And when you see what God does, you have to say, I bow the knee before the Most High, who is the Most High, and there is none like Him. The decree of verse 15 is bow or burn. That's your choice. There's no third option here. You can bow to that image, in which case you'll live. If you don't bow to it, you will burn. Then the second part. Their determination. Here's their response. We've determined we're going to bow. We're going to burn and not bow. And we need to note this. He's closed verse 15 asking, who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Their answer is a classic. I commend it to all of us. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And He will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, if He chooses not to, we don't presume to know His will. We know His power, but we don't presume to know His will. If not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. They said, we will burn before we will bow. The third part of it, you see in the rest of it, we'll see in a moment. God speaks. So Nebuchadnezzar speaks up, bow or burn. They respond, we're going to burn, not bow. And God says, you're neither going to bow nor burn. That's the best part of it all. God is in control. 22 to 24 will emphasize the power of God. We have to reserve that for just a moment. Nebuchadnezzar is actually here not challenging Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, though from the human perspective it appears to be so. He's challenging their God. He's saying, your God, He's going to cost you your lives if you're not careful. You better rethink this. And their response is, our God is able. There's not a question of His power. Today, people get involved in the Holy Spirit debates, and I've never understood why they have said, well, don't you think God is able to let people speak in tongues? Don't you think God is able to do miracles today? God is able to do anything He wants to. It's not a matter of what His ability is. The question is, what is His will? What does He want? And He speaks to us today through His Word. The miracles are written. Our God is able. Remember Matthew 3, verse 9? God is able to raise up sons of Abraham out of these stones. He could. If that's what He wants, He could do it out of these stones. He didn't do that, but He did later, 1 Peter 2. Raise up men to become stones in the temple of God, the house of God. And He's still doing that. Our God is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. He's able to do that. Our God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or even think. And our God is able to save to the uttermost. You know, you see illustrations of these last in Daniel chapter 3. The furnace we need to be concerned about is one described in Matthew 10, 28. God is able to destroy us, soul and body, in hell. That's the fire we better be concerned about. That's the one I think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saw more clearly than the one some man set up. And Ephesians 3:20, he can do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. Look what he's going to do with these three Hebrews. That illustrates that. And then when you consider he's able to save to the uttermost, who would have thought that when these three Hebrews are marched up to the top of the furnace, it was so hot that the flames destroyed the soldiers who took them there, that they would survive falling into the furnace? Who can say? And yet they're walking around in there, not even bound, and the fourth one with them. Can God save to the uttermost? Oh, read Daniel 3 if you want to know the answer to that question. The pernicious pressures. Here's the command of a king. Sometimes we know that a prisoner of war is forced to say something under duress. It's not worth the time it takes to listen to it. He doesn't mean it anyway. He's forced into it. That's what they're trying to do with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The favor of a king. Have you considered the fact it's not just the threat of a king, but the favor of a king that strikes against them on this occasion? Here's a king who, according to chapter 2, verse 49, has set them up in high positions of authority in Babylon. Now they reward him by being unwilling to fall before the image he set up. It sounds very unthankful, doesn't it? I maintain that one of the greatest pressures we'll ever face is not merely this first one, where the brunt force of government or employer or whatever says, you must do this, I don't care what your conscience tells you. One of the hardest things to do is the kinder pressure of our friends, to whom we owe a great debt of gratitude. The kinder pressure of our family, who would never harm us but have done so much in love to help us. That's going to be the greater test. And they had to bear both of these. And then when you look at the peer pressure, everybody else all around them fall. And what do? These three stand out like sore thumbs. You can't escape. Everybody knows who you are and what you're not doing. The threat of punishment, the threat of death, burning. After all, it's just three of you, your little group. You think you're the only ones right and all the rest of us are wrong? You deserve to be burned. Sounds kind of common. Familiar, doesn't it? And the compromise? These people are already idolaters. If we bow down and think of something else rather than of that image, after all, who's going to know? We're not going to make them worse worshipers of an idol. Look at the excuses they could have made. They could have said, there are only three of us. There are only 300 with Gideon. Look how many he was willing to take on. They could have said, we're young. Josiah was very young. He started ruling at the age of 8. He turned to God at a very early age, though his predecessors hadn't been faithful. Look at the fact that they're away from home. So was Joseph. In fact, Joseph's just one, not even three. And Joseph was young. And Joseph is away from home. Who's going to know what he does with Potiphar's wife? Who's going to know what these men do with this image of gold? God knows. This is God-centered theology, as it should be. Everyone else is doing it. Boy, couldn't Noah have said that. And it's no exaggeration. My wife, my children, their wives, and me. 8. Everybody else is doing the wrong thing. What did he do? He did what God wanted. And then if we don't bow, we die. The Lord will lose servants that way. He'd rather lose servants than for you to lose your soul. Now that brings up the persistent servants. Gritty fidelity of these three men deserves all the respect we can give them and the emulation of the example they set on this occasion. They know the truth. They convict themselves by it. They live on the basis of it. We've seen that in chapter 1. And they start with something that the world would call very small. We're not going to eat this defiled food. And they go from that to not bowing down to this idol. Being consistent all the way through is how they're going to be consistent all the way through. You're not going to say, well, yeah, I'll match quarters with you to see who gets it. Oh, that means you believe in gambling, huh? Oh, yeah, you can lose your influence by a little thing. These didn't. They were consistent. They stood firm. We're not going to eat the king's food. We're not going to bow before the king's image. They're not moved by peer pressure. Everybody else is doing it. we're not going to do it. Verse 7 says, literally, as soon as they were hearing, they were falling down. The world gave utter, complete, instantaneous obedience and submission to this image. These did not. They didn't pretend to bow. What if they just bowed down and said, Lord, forgive us for pretending, but we really don't mean this. We really don't mean it. We know that's just an idol. We're bowing down to pray to you, Lord, though the world may think we're bowing down to serve this idol, but we're really not. And then they never hesitated. They didn't say, Nebuchadnezzar, give us some time to think about it. One of the things I have found interesting through the past several years is that in the Apocrypha, 1 Maccabees, during the time, and it's probably the most reliable of any of the books and most historically correct, during the time that the Greek kings were persecuting the Jews, the 160s, so doing horrible things to the Jews, they rallied with the cry, look what our ancestors have done when it was hard for them. And among the three they mention in 1 Maccabees 2:59, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, having believed, were saved from the fire. They refer back to this incident. They believed and they were saved from the fire. They didn't know they would be, though. But they're saying we can do like they did, and many of them did so. They didn't elevate the king over God. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, Jesus said, but sometimes Caesar wants the Lord's part as well. And when that occurs, he must be opposed, as he is in Daniel 3. And then they trusted and obeyed God. They did not doubt or presume. They didn't say, our God will save us from the fire. You just watch and see. They didn't know what they would die. But if that's what it took to show their faith and to be faithful, that's what they would do. And they were willing to die for their faith. Let the king do his worst. God will either deliver us from death or through death. Either way, it's deliverance. During World War I, there was a chaplain who wrote home to his little boy. And he said, the first prayer I want my son to learn to say for me is not, God keep Daddy safe, but God make Daddy brave. And if he has hard things to do, make him strong to do them. Life and death don't matter, my son, right and wrong do. Daddy dead is Daddy still. But Daddy dishonored before God is something awful, too bad for words. I suppose you'd like to put in a bit about safety too, old chap, and mother would. We'll put it in, but afterwards, always afterwards, because it really does not matter near so much. This man would rush in between both German and American lines and there in the battlefields of France, find craters to pull the wounded men into to try to save them from both sides, and still didn't lose his life. He prayed that he would be brave. May I submit to you that if you're going to be a certain, faithful child of God, a Christian in this day and age, you're going to need to be brave. You're going to need to have the attitude of a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that says, I don't care what the world thinks. I don't care what the world will do. My course is clear. My God is the one who truly reigns. And I'm going to hold to His word. It doesn't matter what else happens. Their reward, the furnace that is so hot, turns into a walk in the park. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Here you have a hot king who has a hot furnace. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This proves it was humanly impossible to survive that fire if the man If the men who took them to the edge of it are killed, they couldn't have survived in this fire. Humanly, it's impossible. God is working a miracle here to save them. 23 says, then these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down. They didn't bow down, but they fell down bound into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They said to the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God, or as you see in a footnote, a son of the gods. I don't know what his view of this was. This is impressive testimony for a heathen. In verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Nebuchadnezzar, who's the Most High? Not me. Not that image. The God of heaven. Come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. How can this be? Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember the question he asked in verse 15? Who is the God who will deliver you? And now he's saying, oh, that God. The God I didn't know. And the result, he said, he sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. They frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. And their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there's no other God who can deliver like this. You know, Nebuchadnezzar had gone to Jerusalem. He had defeated the Jews. 606 takes away these folks. 597 goes back, takes away a much larger group. 586, third trip. I don't know at what point this occurs. But since he goes to Jerusalem, their home, where they serve their God, where their temple is, and defeats them and brings them back, what's his conclusion? I'm more powerful than their God. You know what produced that? The infidelity, the faithlessness of the Jews who lived in that city. And God's name was blasphemed, Isaiah 52 tells us, because of their sins. The nations around the world were saying, here's a God greater than Israel's God. It was not true. It was God who fought for Nebuchadnezzar and gave these people into his hand to punish them for their lack of faith. And now he's saying, I'm going to have to rethink my equation here. Something is amiss. I defeated them, therefore I defeated their God, or so I thought. But no God can deliver like this. No God can. And in verse 30, what does he do? He promotes them. He promotes them. You know why they're promoted? Because they stood. The higher we go in this world, the greater we become a target to people like a Nebuchadnezzar. And they're going to try to cut our legs out from under us. They're going to try to bring us down. I know a man who was involved in government work. He was going from the state level to the federal level. And he asked a friend of mine what he thought about it. He said, well, I think you're jumping from the frying pan to the fire. If you thought it was tough on the local level, you just wait till you get into the federal level. And that's pretty much what he said took place. But you become a target. Not wrong for you to go that route, but you become a target. And if you're going to be faithful as a child of God, you're going to become a target. The fearless, pious conduct of three Jews made God's name known in Babylon. Someone said, we no longer live in a post-Christian society. We live in an anti-Christian society, one in which the Christian faith is dismissed or ridiculed, and Christians are considered suspect, and their motives and behavior berated. Eusebius, the great historian of the church, was persecuted by Valens, the Roman emperor. He was threatened with confiscation of all his goods, with torture, with banishment, or death. Eusebius' reply was this. It's a classic reply. He needs not fear confiscation who has nothing to lose, nor banishment to whom heaven is his country, nor torments when his body can be destroyed at one blow, nor death, which is the only way to set him at liberty from sin and sorrow. Today we have situations where you may own a bakery, and people will try every way they can to put you at odds with the government, and you'll end up paying over $100,000 to those who sued you because you wouldn't take the part in an immoral marriage, and you lose your business. You may have a photography shop, and because you refuse the same kind of immoral association with immoral marriages, they sue you and they take away your business. Or it may be that you're a Christian working on a job where you are being everything short of tortured. And you say, I can't take this anymore. I need to get out of this in some way. And you conceive of an immoral way to rid yourself of this horrible experience. And you tell one of your friends about it. And he says, now listen. The problem is that the people know you. This is a true story, by the way. They have been watching you. If you fail, it won't be your failure, but the failure of Christianity. Well, that settled it for him. He stuck it out. He did what he needed to do. He acted like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. 2 Timothy 1:12, for this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I'm not ashamed. For I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep what I've committed to him until that day. Andrew led us in number 400 a moment ago. An outstanding song. But did you remember the fourth stanza of this song? When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie. Well, 1 Peter 1 talks about fiery trials. 1 Peter 4 talks about fiery trials. Every chapter of 1 Peter talks about persecution. Through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie. My grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. I'm burning away the bad stuff. I don't mean anything bad to you. I'm purifying you. And he led us also in Dare to Stand Like Joshua. Both of them, excellent illustrations of what you see in Daniel chapter 3. And then he led us in, My God is able to deliver thee. And we see that this evening as we look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some things don't turn out as we think they should. I don't think they were turning out as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thought they should. But one thing about it, they were determined that God was in this business, that God would do whatever it was God needed to do in harmony with His will. They didn't know what His will was concerning their living or dying, but they're willing to die if that's His will. May that be the attitude of every one of us. May we have the courage of these three young men who are willing to die rather than to recant their faith and shame the God who saved them. Could it be that someone in this audience has never obeyed the gospel of Christ? Peter announced to the people in Acts 2, repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. If you've done this and have turned aside and owe the Lord a duty as one who has abandoned Him and need to come back, if in any way you're subject to Him, come, why don't we stand together and sing.